Hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. It is Thursday, November the 20th, 2025. And in spite of the fact that I apparently don't know the name of my own podcast, this is episode 3763. Maybe with a little more practice, I'll actually get the name of the show right 100% of the time. Anyway, it is Thursday. I do know what that means. It is time for the Expert Council Q&A show for the week. And after shaking the piker tree, I've got maybe one or two additional segments in the bank for next week, because the next week is Thanksgiving, so there won't be a Thanksgiving show. But we're still thin on content, but I got a bunch of stuff for you. In fact, I've even got two people today that I don't think you've ever heard from before in an expert council show. One's been on the show a couple times. That is Rand Gifford. And if you're wondering who Rand is, but the name sounds familiar, especially if you've been to Workshop or Three, Rand is the guy that runs Akira Botanicals. And then there's another gentleman that some of you just met at a workshop. His name is Antonio Gatto, and he will also be on today. But here's the full lineup we've got today. Chris Rossini and Ron Paul will lead off with the Ron Paul Liberty highlights, which is typical for a Thursday show. And their observation is interesting this week, to me anyway. The government was just shut down for the record longest shutdown in government history, and in that time, they spent $620 billion while shut down. Yeah, okay, we'll just leave that what it is. Then Nicole Sauce has an interesting little suggestion here from a standpoint of preparedness skill. Show up nervous. What does that mean? I'm not going to tell you. I'll let Nicole do it when her segment comes up. And then Rand Gifford from Akira. Some of you probably snapped to exactly what Rand will be talking about. I don't know if we have enough questions to bring Rand on as a regular member of the council, but he's a super smart guy. He's an awesome business owner. He's built an incredible business with Akira Botanicals, along with some other stuff he's built as a businessman, too. But Akira, of course, is main product set is the CBD and hemp-derived cannabis product market. And I am a customer of Rand's for that particular thing. Particularly, I use gummies right about an hour before bed, and they give me a more restful sleep. And I do use the psychoactive ones that make you high, you know, the not just the CBD, which is what my wife prefers. But in the clean CR, when they finally ended the government shutdown, somehow the snake snaked in a thing that effectively bans the vast majority of hemp-derived product on the market today, including many of the CBD products because of an arbitrary number. I don't know if this will stand. That's kind of Rand's thing as well, at least in the form that it's in right now. This is a huge industry with its own lobbyists at this point. But I don't know what exactly this means and where we stand right now with it. And I figured a person who makes their living off of it would know more than me. So I reached out to Rand. So he's going to give you a few moments of his time to explain what the bill currently means and how arbitrary the number restriction placed upon it is. I'll throw some follow-up on that of what I think is most likely to happen, because in spite of some bullshit hype, no one's being raided in freaking the Carolinas or whatever at a convenience store because of this bill, because it doesn't actually, the restrictions don't go in effect for a year, which I think is also telling in of itself. Next up, Antonio Gatto. That's another name I gave you in the introduction. This is a super nice guy. Tall as fuck, too, by the way. Really good dude. Came to my workshop, super kind of super excited guy, kind of got us excited about everything, and really super nice. But in talking to him, I also found out he's super smart. And he's deeply involved in the home improvement market and the real estate investment market. Those are two great subjects. I would like to bring him on full-time as an expert council member. So this is a guy that can help you with things like replacing the flooring in your house or getting bids on construction work or remodel work, along with how to invest in real estate. I think it's an awesome, awesome addition. I had him kind of do an audition segment for you guys, so I'd like you to listen to that. Maybe get to know Antonio a little bit and ask yourself, is there something I can ask Antonio? That'd actually be a good podcast title, wouldn't it be? Ask Antonio. Anyway, can you ask Antonio a question for me? Can you guys send me a couple more questions? Because I think if we can get this guy off to a good start, we have a new all-star in the making on the Expert Council, which is, well, it's made up of all-stars, right? It's an all-star team. Jesse Markowitz will be talking about Stingray devices. This is something I've known about for a very long time, but it did turn out at the workshop when Jesse mentioned this technology. There's a tremendous number of people that don't know these things exist. What is the Stingray device? I'll just say for now, it has to do with cell phones. It's something you probably should at least be aware of. And I'll let Jesse take it from there. Then Matthew Sersley, it's a good time of year to start thinking about this too, we'll talk about five businesses you can set up mainly for tax purposes. Now, we don't set up businesses only for the tax write-offs. We set up businesses because they make sense in our life and they make us money. But they also allow us to move a great deal of expense that we're already spending from the category of spending on ourselves to spending inside a business and therefore reducing our tax footprint. What I'm saying is even a business that makes a profit can actually have you pay less taxes than not having a business in the first place. Especially for many of you who are in that step-over world between the corporate world and the business owner world where you kind of have both things going on, the side hustle approach. And then I have a question. It's the first time I ever got this question, and the answer, the short answer is simple. Fire his ass and get a new one. But the more thoughtful answer requires a bit more thinking. And I'm actually surprised I never got this question. What do you do if you feel trapped with your investments, and specifically your investment advisor? Let's say you got an investment advisor when you were young. The young lady that wrote in is only 27. And so I already applaud her for even having investments in an investment advisor at 27. More people would do well to follow that example. But she's been listening to my show along with her boyfriend. They like the show. And they are interested in broadening their mindset on investments. And I'm going to give a couple different ways that this can be approached, because what she said is they feel like they're stuck with their advisor. You're not stuck. But does your advisor really suck, or are your expectations in the right place? Do you know what it means when you say you want to do other things? He might suck. Honestly, most of them do. There's a reason I coined the term all the way back in 2008, financial liar, instead of financial advisor. There's only a few good ones, and the very best ones generally work with people with significant net worth that younger investors generally don't quite have yet. But there's some good ones out there, and we'll talk about how to find a good one. And hint, hint, nod, nod, there's someone you might want to reach out to. And then we'll also talk about how you can take better control of this situation yourself, how to have conversations with an advisor, and when those conversations lead you to the understanding that I need a new guy. Even if I'm going to keep a guy, I need a new guy, because this isn't the guy for me. Because some of the guys really aren't the guy for you. I'll save my additional thoughts on that till we get there. With that in mind, before we jump in today, I want to remind you guys that you can always help support this show by doing your online shopping starting at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. I want to just give you kind of all the items of the day, real lightning round fast for the week. And that is the 22-quart roaster oven by Aroma. Take back your oven for Thanksgiving with one of these, for Christmas, and for big events. These are great. They don't cost much money. They can cook a turkey or a roast perfectly. You can't do with a crock pot what you can do with a roaster oven. They're basically a portable oven that sits on a countertop and gives you all the oven space back. The Hamilton Beach 3-in-1 egg cooker. The meter block thermometer set, which is on sale. And what I brought to you yesterday, first time I ever brought it to you, the Merton & Stork carbon steel skillets. These things are amazing. If you're looking for cookware that you can cook at like a true chef's level with, beautifully milled, nice sides, perfectly designed, excellent pre-seasoning on them, a pan that will only get better over time, something that you would think you would pay like $150 a pan for, and you want to pay the same price as Lodge, you need to check out Merton & Stork. That's M-E-R-T-E-N and S-T-O-R-C-K. Check the show notes today for links to all of those items. Also, Laws of Life, Ditch the System, Design Your Life by Jack Spirico, is on sale for a few bucks off. Again, until I get tired of the extra orders coming in for the year, on the year's end. And the MSB is on sale for $35 a year. Discount code is Turkey, and that sale ends on Black Monday, I guess, or Cyber Monday is when it ends. So, because Black Friday leads to Cyber Monday. So on that Monday after Thanksgiving, that sale ends. And I would take advantage of it now if you want to, because I don't care if your dog ate your discount code. When I put a sunset date on something, I kind of mean it. With that in mind now, let's go ahead and listen to Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini on how the government shut down. They were, oh my God, it shut down. Where are we going to be? And somehow they still spent $620 billion while they were shut down.
The Republican headlines, remember when they solved the problem temporarily, the Democrats caved, we won. You know, if this is what winning looks like, you know, put up that article. This is from Heads, but this is Eric Peters, CIO of One River Asset Management, wrote the article. But you can actually see the same figure throughout the web. U.S. debt rose by $620 billion during the government shutdown. I think it was 42 days, maybe 47. I don't remember exactly. Here's what the House Freedom Caucus wrote. This package, i.e. the settlement, demonstrates that we can govern without surrendering to big spending or letting Democrats dictate priorities. This is the Freedom Caucus, not the Spending Caucus. Anyway, they continue, we successfully stiff-armed the massive omnibus spending bill. We locked in disciplined flat spending levels, preserved President Trump's policy priorities, and kept our leverage for the next round in January. This is the victory cry, Dr. Paul, of the House Freedom Caucus. I have to say, if this is victory, it almost feels hopeless.
Boy, that's for sure. And, you know, the Freedom Caucus, that sounds like a good thing, but I don't think Thomas is in it.
No, he's not in it.
So we can't expect a whole lot. But I think, to be realistic, you shouldn't expect a whole lot. Because when a government gets out of control and the people's demands get out of control and people are politically and patriotically dedicated to empire, that's the one that really annoys me, because all you have to do is talk about that. And yet we're hoping that we're making some inroads to that, and some people are starting to say, hey, wait a minute. You know, we could use a little bit of that money here at home.
Yeah.
Maybe we ought to take care of some of our problems before we send more billions of dollars. And it hasn't slowed up. You know, I wonder how much. I haven't added it up, but the money flow into the Ukrainian thing and the Middle East, it continues.
Sure.
So, and then we wonder why we're bankrupt.
I think the thing that I take away most from this number of $620 billion spent during the shutdown is how much of government spending is completely non-discretionary and automatic. If you want to think about it that way. Like, you know, interest on the debt to the tune of $1 trillion a year. Then we have programs that they always hold up as, oh my God, they won't get, just to like scare old people during a shutdown, like Social Security and all. But we're going to spend that money no matter what. And then all the government employees who had to work without pay, they all get back paid. So we actually spent way more than $620 billion during the shutdown. That's just how much money still went out the door. And then the back pay once the CR pass got done. The whole thing's a gimmick and the whole thing's a joke and nobody's going to fix it and no one's coming to save you. And you better take very clear control of your economic future starting now. The best time to do it was 10 years ago. The best time before that was another 20 years ago. But the next best time is, since you didn't do that, today. It is time to be very serious about the economic future of this country, realizing we don't have one. This golden age Trump keeps talking of is not coming back. Even if there's a brief party at some point, it will not last. This is a country straight into $40 trillion in debt, and it will never stop growing. It will only grow faster than it's grown in the past. That's how debt like this works. There is no plan to slow it down, to reduce it, to pay it off. It does not exist. And Trump's sitting here telling you that 2% inflation is perfect, but he's targeting 1% because you need some, and that's a little bit better. But 1% inflation doesn't erase the massive inflation we've had over the past 10 freaking years, Orange Man. The country is screwed. The economy is screwed because the dollar is screwed. Let me put it a different way to you. This will be in my upcoming book, One of the Laws of Life, in there. If your ruler is variable in length, all your measurements are bullshit. Okay? So if you're measuring your life in dollars, well, and that, so that's your unit of measure, like inches or feet or centimeters or meters or yards, right? Or miles. You're using the dollar as an economic mechanism to gauge your progress, and the value of the dollar is in terminal decline forever by design and plan, then all your economic planning is basically bullshit. If you're not using hard assets in your investments so that you're actually building value, retaining value, and have value that can be leveraged in the future against the declining currency. Now, you'll never hear those words on Fox News or CNN or MSNBC or any money show or come out of somebody's mouth like Dave Ramsey or frickin' Jim Cramer, opposite ends of the spectrum there, and there's a reason. You're not supposed to know this. This is something that only the billionaires are supposed to know, but in the information age, if you want to know something, you can. I, for one, once I figure something out, refuse to shut up about it and let you know about it. So you do with that as you will. Now, let's go on to something a little more practical for the average person. A tip from Nicole Sauce. If you need to show up for something and you're going to be nervous, well, show up nervous. What does she mean by that? You're about to find out.
Howdy, TSP. Nicole Sauce here from the Living Free in Tennessee podcast and Holler Roast Coffee. And I am coming to you today to talk about something we don't cover much in the preparedness world. And what we're going to cover today is the skill of showing up nervous, even when you're the one who's supposed to have it all together. So this week, I testified in front of my county commissioners about some proposed land use zoning regulations and codes. And here's the deal. I've spent 14 years working in public policy before I eventually moved on to doing Holler Roast Coffee and my podcast. I speak on stages in front of hundreds and sometimes thousands of people. I host events. I teach classes. I talk. I basically talk for a living, right? So it was kind of a surprise to me when this one hit differently, because the thing was, I was talking about my home and our leaders are about to roll out the same land use ideas that ruined Oregon, which is why I left Oregon. And I'm not really interested in watching Tennessee repeat that mistake, which is verifiably a mistake at this point. You can see it there with the pushing of populations around, housing becoming unaffordable, and a whole lot of other things. So this issue was really personal. And when I started telling my story, like my real story of why I moved here and how long I've been here, my voice started shaking, my throat tightened up, and I could hear myself kind of warbling of all things. So it would have been really easy at that moment to just shorten what I was going to say and step away. But instead, I kept going. I stuck to the points. I finished 45 seconds early. And afterwards, one of the commissioners came up to me and said, as long as I'm in office, I'm not voting for zoning here. So that's when I kind of thought, you know, there's a lesson here. Being prepared isn't just food storage or gear or skills. It's having the courage to show up nervous, especially when something really, really matters. And on the local level, we can still make changes that impact us directly and impact our neighbors directly. And I think that's the difference between being a spectator and somebody who shapes the world they want to live in. We talk about building the life you choose here at Living Free in Tennessee. But if you don't take the steps to shape it around you, eventually you're going to end up back having your life lived for you by societal standards. So most people wait until they feel confident before taking action. And I think that's a big mistake. Confidence is a result, not a prerequisite of doing things. So you earn it by doing them before you feel ready to do them, if you think about that, right? So my practical takeaway for anybody sitting in an apartment dreaming about land or wishing they could afford that Tennessee property, but not sure how they can do it, and just wanting to be more free, is practice showing up. Even when you're shaky, especially when it's personal, put yourself outside of your comfort zone and start standing up for things that matter, or going to events that you're a little bit afraid to be at. Ask the question, join a group, Take that first step to build the life you want, even if your heart is kind of nervous about it, your palms are sweating. That probably means you're doing the right thing, man. It probably means you're doing the right thing. Because if you can do something nervous, you'll do it with strength and confidence later. And I think that's real preparedness. So speaking of showing up, let's talk about something a little bit lighter now. We're headed straight into gift giving season. And if you're like me, you might suddenly realize it's December 22nd. You haven't done anything about it. Well, I can help you with that now, a month in advance, and then you don't have to be there. So if you're a little nervous about managing your gift list, I can help you. I can help you a lot. At Hollow Roast Coffee, we've got some really solid gift ideas that check both useful and delicious and supports a real person instead of a giant corporation. And that's things like our classic coffee tin, which we just launched. And so it's a really cool reusable tin. We have one called Carols and Coffee that has some Christmas branding on it that we added. And then, of course, we'll have Jack's Bourbon Cooled Coffee, very limited this year. I can't resupply that bean at the moment due to some environments in the coffee world. So we're only going to have 40 pounds of that available this year. We've got chocolate covered espresso bites, sampler packs, all sorts of stuff. But here's the really cool part. I can manage your entire gift list if you ask me to. We can work together. All you got to do is reach out, Nicole@livingfreeintennessee.com, or fill out the form at hollerroast.com, and we can set you up for multiple recipients, different addresses, a personal handwritten note to each, the whole thing, and then you're done. You're done with Christmas. You're done with the hard part, and you can focus in on what's really important, which is spending time with your family and loved ones as we go into the season. So if you want to give gifts that land well and avoid last-minute chaos, head over to hollerroast.com, fill out the contact form if you want to do a multiple gift thing, and we'll work together, and show up nervous, or maybe not so nervous, with a really fantastic consumable gift that will not clutter up a house. But show up, man. Show up. Make it a great week.
All right, so one thing I want to throw in here, actually two things that I think would be beneficial to everybody listening is, number one, you would think people like Nicole or myself, we don't get nervous when we have to speak in front of people. And sometimes we don't and sometimes we do. But I think admitting that sometimes you get nervous, sometimes you worry about a presentation or a talk that you're going to give, helps people feel encouraged because, well, if that's the case for me or Nicole or someone like us, then it's perfectly normal that you would feel the same way, especially if you're new to speaking in public, whether it's at something like an event or whether it's like at a meeting, like a political thing like Nicole went to. But I also want to say the other thing, like most of the time when I get up in front of a room, whether it's 50 people, 500 people, or a couple thousand people, I'm not nervous. I know why I'm there, and I know the subject that I'm speaking to, and I know that the only risk I'm taking is to myself and my personal reputation, and perhaps a little bit to the event organizers if it's not my event. But even then, I've been to plenty of events and thought, oh, this speaker seems great, and went and sat down and it wasn't very good. And I never judged the event organizer if that was a one or two off. If everybody sucked, well, that's different, right? So what I'm saying there is that when I'm speaking on biochar or business development or anything else, whether it starts with a B or not, I'm speaking as Jack Spirko for Jack Spirko in relationship to Jack Spirko's reputation. And that means that if I blow something, the only person that I've harmed is myself. When you're speaking on behalf of others, and a significant portion of others, like an entire county, as Nicole was talking about there, the calculus shifts in your mind. If I fail now, I'm failing others. And that is a large weight to carry. Even when you're going into a situation like what she did mattered, and it made a difference, but there's also the reality she could have done everything right. She could have even done better than she intended, or better than she's capable of, and it still could have quote-unquote failed, right? Because you don't know how much lobbyist money's coming in to push these boilerplate freaking regulations and codes. So it sounds like she had really good success, and it sounds like, you know, at least for a time, maybe that's staved off in her county. Because when you win somebody over like that on a council, a lot of times they talk to other members and, hey, we don't need to do, like, what's the problem we're trying to solve is the biggest thing I would always try to get, especially when dealing with city council, town council, county board, things like that at that local level. If you're going to do this thing, what problem are you trying to solve? Do we even need to do anything, let alone this? And that a lot of times at that local level will get through and does make a difference. Even when you do everything right, and even at that level, it can still fail. But you still hold it to yourself that, like, you know, how many people are in your county? Tens of thousands? And you're going there to try to make a difference on their behalf. That's different. I'll tell you another place that it makes a difference. It's going to sound funny, but how about playing Santa Claus? You know, I've been doing the Santa Claus beard thing this year. And Dorothy and I joke that's our retirement plan. We'll set up a Santa business or something and work 2 months a year. We probably won't. But I actually have experience playing Santa Claus for kids to believe, little kids. I had a family who had a really cool old-school Santa suit, like not the cheap-ass ones in the mall. And they were pretty good at what they did, including, like, additional makeup and things like that. And I did 2 years in a row for them where I was Santa because the family member who had used to done it had deceased and was not able to do it anymore. I was to the point like you get in the suit and then you sneak outside and you come to the door and you go in, you give all, you know, a big bag of presents and you hand them out to kids. Now, you might think that a guy that can stand up in front of a room of 500, 5,000 people and speak without a hitch would not be nervous surrounded by 10 little kids. But when you're the guy that could screw up Santa for little kids, ruin their last year or two of really believing in the magic, bro, it is stressful. So it's perfectly normal to be nervous when you show up to speak or talk or do anything that matters. If you're not nervous, it probably means either you've done it so many times, you've gotten past it, or what you're doing really matters and affects other people. And it is a great tip by Nicole. Show up and do it anyway, because it's the only way that you'll ever get actually good at doing it. With that, let's move on. Now let's hear from Rand Gifford on what the sleazy slimeballs did during the government shutdown and passing the CR and this thing that got, you know, flown in the last couple moments and appended to a bill that was not supposed to have anything to do with it in regards to hemp.
Hey guys, it's Rand with Acura Botanicals. I just wanted to give everybody kind of an update. People have been asking about this recent hemp ban that came through. And so this is basically what happened. They snuck a provision into the spending bill that will essentially limit total THC in all products to 0.4 milligrams per container. Now, the legislation makes no sense, first of all, because 0.4 milligrams is a very arbitrary number. You know, to give it perspective on this, our CBD oil, which is non-psychoactive, it's not going to get you high, but it is from a full spectrum oil, meaning we're extracting all the cannabinoids out of the flower, the terpenes, the flavonoids, all that stuff, and that's what makes it an effective product. You know, there might be 2 milligrams to 3 milligrams of THC per dropper in there. It's such a low amount. It's not enough to get anybody high. But this legislation essentially does away. It's just kind of a bludgeon. And they picked a very arbitrary number at 0.4 milligrams, which makes no sense. And so the results of this is, yeah, I mean, as it stands right now, it will essentially make it so that no full spectrum CBD products, including things like salve, will exist. And the only thing you will have potentially is just isolates, which, you know, any products made with isolates, they're essentially isolating a single compound like the CBD molecule. And that's all there is. But when you do that, it really it kind of reduces the effectiveness of the product because you're not getting all the other compounds of the plant. And so I don't know if this will stand. It's very innocuous how they snuck it in. I think they just wanted to pass the bill, and that's why, you know, they knew both sides were going to vote on it to reopen the government. And so I'm not sure what the process for amending this provision is. Maybe there's probably somebody who could speak on that better than myself. But in terms of how it affects the hemp industry, I mean, in terms of disruption, it's a 10. It's about as big as it could get. And so we'll see if it stands. I know there's a lot of people that are pushing back against it on both sides of the aisle. And, you know, we'll see what happens. But yeah, as it stands right now, we basically have a year, and then the hemp industry will change forever. And like I said, I would understand if they wanted to limit things like THC products that are getting people high, edibles that look like candy. And I'm all in favor of that too. But to just essentially wipe out, you know, all full spectrum CBD products makes no sense. It's probably going to force people to go to the black market, which means they won't be getting any test results. There won't be a brand or somebody behind it that they can trust. It's just all going to be on Telegram or whatever. And so it basically makes the industry less safe. It makes it so people who use this stuff, who depend on this, it makes it harder for them to get the things that are helping them. And if you want to know who benefits the most, I don't even think it's the alcohol industry. I think it's the pharmaceutical lobbies. The pharmaceutical companies that are losing profits to people who aren't taking their pills. Instead, they're helping, you know, they're finding relief with pain and insomnia and anxiety in a natural product like, you know, CBD oil. And so it's very disappointing on that front as well. But, you know, I'll keep you guys posted on everything. We'll see how this all pans out. But, you know, it's kind of just, it's part of this industry. Every year it's changing, and sometimes it changes fast. So we'll just roll with the punches, and, you know, we'll see what happens.
So my instinct is this was rapid boilerplate, and the restriction was actually intended to be per dose or something like that, because it completely and totally destroys the industry. Now, the other side is that might have been planned, but as I said, lobbyists fight with other lobbyists over lobbyist agendas, and the hemp industry is now a multi-billion dollar industry with their own lobbyists. So I see this in some way being at least partially course corrected between now and the next year. Somebody will bury something into some bill somewhere. As far as Rand saying he doesn't understand what the amendment process is, the amendment process is any new legislation can have new statements that counteract the old and thereby replace it. Like, this is not like a constitutional amendment, like where you would want to change something in the Constitution. Any piece of legislation could have any sort of rider, amendment, additional component added into it just like this and change what was done in this one. So the process isn't hard. The consensus may be difficult. But I see somebody somewhere in the Senate or the House being gifted enough money into their, you know, contributions for campaigns to apply something that slightly modifies this in some way. Because I don't think even the people who voted for it actually intended the result that was obtained. The way this was marketed is this is going to shut down all the synthetic bullshit that's being sold in gas stations and convenience stores. But it's not even close to the truth, which is typical for government. I do want to point something out about cannabis and hemp legislation as a whole. The number one, the top three lobbyists who spend money to try to bring further restrictions to that market are big pharmaceutical, big alcohol, and the prison lobby. Let that sink in. Now, I'm going to tell you something else, though, that you might not snap to. The actual source of this may be, believe it or not, big marijuana. Big marijuana. Because you know what's not affected? The billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars and full-on get-high-off-your-ass marijuana sold through state-licensed dispensaries. See how that works? So who benefits the most here? Who benefits the most here? The companies that grow good old-fashioned but new-age pot and sell it through licensed distribution systems, where they now have to compete with people like Rand and Akira Botanicals, because you can't buy exactly the same thing, but you can get the same result buying product that is mailed to you. You see how that works? So I actually think that the culprit in this is big marijuana, which may seem counterintuitive, but I'll put it to you this way. In Texas, there is a limited number of licenses to legally sell fireworks during a very short part of the year. A couple weeks leading up to the 4th of July and like right around New Year's Eve. And to get one of those licenses, you have to buy it from somebody, or somebody has to die who didn't will it to somebody, and then it becomes available for a bid. Okay? Do you know who doesn't want to open up fireworks sales any longer than those two short windows? The people that have the permits already. And you know who doesn't want to issue any more permits? The people who have the permits already. And that says everything. Because if you have one of those permits, you can literally work about 4 weeks a year and make a full-time income. Because you are hiding under the gilding provided by the protection of a permit from the state. And that's why I suspect that big marijuana is the actual culprit in this. Somebody that very few people would expect or suspect. But if you follow pattern recognition, it's the most logical conclusion you can come to. When something happens, and it's something you would have preferred not to happen, before you jump to any conclusions, at least ask a simple question. And that is always, who benefits the most from this thing? That will usually lead you in the direction, if not the actual location of the truth. Next up, let's hear from Antonio Gatto, our newest prospective expert council member on investing in homes, either to flip or to rent to others.
Hello, TSP community. This is Antonio Gatto coming to you from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. My name may be new to most of you, so with that, I would like to offer a quick introduction. I am 43 years old. I am Pittsburgh born and raised, and for the past 24 years, I have been a registered home improvement contractor in the state of Pennsylvania. I specialize in both exterior and interior work, and I am here to answer all of your questions regarding DIY and any future home improvement projects you are looking to take on. I am also the operating member of Morning Rain Holdings, LLC in Pittsburgh, PA, where we offer rentals to the public and we flip homes for resale. With that, let's get started today. First question comes in from Tom and Maria. Tom writes, "Hello, Antonio. I have recently been reading a lot of articles and seeing videos on TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram on how investing in real estate is very advantageous and also a great way to allow for passive income. Whether it is flipping homes or leasing, both options appear like it is a very simple process and the payout is a win-win. Being that we are new to this sector, I was hoping you would be able to provide some clarity for my wife and I on potentially entering this new endeavor. You could definitely make the claim that we are rookies. I currently work in IT and my wife is in the medical industry. I would like to know if these articles are sugarcoating real estate and what it is really like to own it and run it, and if they are leaving out crucial information or tips that are usually not mentioned. Any guidance that you could provide us would be a huge help. Thank you so much for your time, Tom and Maria." Well, Tom and Maria, that is a fantastic question. And quite frankly, I wish more people would approach real estate in the manner that you have, because you are not looking at it with rose-colored glasses. And that is a big mistake that a lot of people have a tendency to make. So what I'm going to do for you is I'm going to put together a list of five things that you should definitely do prior to getting into real estate, whether or not you are buying a property to flip or you are going to flip it and keep it as a rental unit. Number one, the first thing that you need to do is form an LLC. The reason for this is because you do not want to leave yourself vulnerable and exposed to your personal assets, where an LLC protects you from that. What's called a corporate veil is what gives you that protection. I would encourage anybody to do that. You could certainly buy property as a sole proprietor, but what I don't like about that idea, it leaves you very vulnerable and open to your personal assets being seized should something happen, and that's not something that I would ever want to see anybody go through. Secondly, I think it is very important that most investors understand that the more holdings that you have, meaning real estate, you should have more LLCs. One LLC should cover each of your properties. The reason for that is because if a lawsuit should ever take place, they can only go after the individual LLC. If you only have one LLC and you have multiple properties, all of those properties could be seized in the event that you should lose the court case. And I do not want to see anybody go through that. I witnessed that happen to other people in the past, so that is something that I practice and that I always advise people to do. Secondly, we need to clear the air on something that you mentioned in your letter to me, and that is that real estate is passive income. That is a complete misconception. There is nothing passive about real estate. Real estate is active. People that get into real estate need to understand that right out of the gate. I cannot emphasize enough how important that is. And why is that, you might ask? Well, homes are mechanical. And what happens to anything that's mechanical? They break. Things fall apart. pipe spring a leak, roof leaks. This is a common occurrence. If you are a landlord, you will be receiving calls at any given time, and this is something that you emotionally and mentally need to prepare for if you want to go down that road. It sounds like you are open to both being a landlord and just flipping. So that's something that you definitely need to take into consideration as well. Also, are you going to be doing this work yourself, or do you have a reliable contractor? If you do not have a reliable contractor, you should interview some. You should become acquainted with some, because if you do not have the capabilities to do the repairs on your own in a timely manner, you need to have somebody that will be available when that need should arise. And it's not a question of when it will arise. It's not a question of if it shall arise. It's a question of when it shall arise. So that is something that you need to understand too. Thirdly is location, location, location. You've heard that said so many times in real estate, and I personally cannot emphasize that enough. A question that you need to ask yourself is, when you are buying a piece of property, if you had to ask yourself, how quickly would this house sell 2 months from now, and would it be easy to sell? And that is with an optimal price. And what I mean by optimal price is fair market value. If it would be very difficult to sell for reasons such as too close to other properties, a very difficult area to get to navigate, if it is up on a hill with hundreds of steps to get to, these are all deterrents that most buyers would see. And just because the price is cheap does not necessarily negate the reason that you should be buying it. Fourth, if you're rehabbing yourself, do you have the knowledge and the time? You mentioned in your letter that you work in IT and your wife works in the medical industry. I'm going to assume that both of you work full time. And if that is the case, I really think that you should take into consideration how much time it is going to take you to actually flip a home. To do that in a timely manner, it's not going to be a weekend project. This is something that you are going to have to dedicate full time to. And if you don't have the time to do it, you are going to be hiring out. And with that, you are talking a lot more money, where the deal of a lifetime may potentially barely turn into a deal once it's all said and done. I've seen that happen so many times with couples and individuals that have bought homes. And it's not something that I'd like to see people go through, because once again, they go in with rose-colored glasses thinking they are going to make a boatload of money, where in the end, they may be a little bit above even, but was it worth it? Not all the stress and not all the aggravation. And finally, if you are going to be a landlord, do you have a budget? And do you have a repair fund? I always suggest that people have a minimum of $5,000 to $10,000 in a savings account put aside for repairs should something go wrong. Is it a little bit of excessive? Yes, but I would rather err on the side of caution of having a little bit more than not having enough. There's nothing like having the safe haven of a nest egg that is used specifically for an emergency fund of covering the cost of any repairs to your rentals. So I could elaborate on so much more in each one of these categories right now, but we are limited on our time here. So if you have any questions pertaining to any of that, please send them over to Jack. Jack will email me, and I will do my absolute best to get back to you in a very timely manner. With that, have a great rest of the week, and never stop learning. Have a great day.
So first, that was an excellent segment, and I think Antonio could be a huge benefit to this audience, both from a real estate investment concept and from like understanding bids, processes, home improvement projects, selecting materials, all that, because to be a good real estate investor, especially a house flipper, you have to be able to do a lot of that for yourself, and you have to be able to effectively hire people to do the things that you don't have the time to do or don't have the expertise to do as well. So I think from hiring contractors to doing the work yourself to actually doing real estate, because it doesn't have to be real estate, it could be living in your own home and fixing it up, I think Antonio would be great. Please send me questions for him. Give this guy some runway to ramp up, and I think questions will pour in for him. He may become one of the most popular people to ask questions of that we have if you give him some runway. So please do that for me, because the dude is solid as fuck, okay? That's how I'm going to put it. I got to meet this guy, and I don't generally meet a person and instantly say yes to doing something like this. So that tells you something. The other side of it, I do want to comment on the subject itself with the part-time methodology. I don't know if Antonio would agree with this, but I've met enough people who have done this that it makes sense to me that it's an angle to take as a part-time person. The most successful way that I've seen people get into the rental markets when renting is, you know, like doing real estate is not their full-time gig. They have a job, whether it's two partners with a job or an individual with a job. They find a home they're willing to live in at the level it's at that needs a lot of work, okay, where they can buy it at a deal, right, a price that's going to make sense once the renovations are done. They live in the home while they renovate it. So they don't fully settle in. They go with modest furniture that's easy to move around for work, maybe secondhand thrift store shit as well to save money, and they pay go on their renovation. And they take a year, or maybe their first one is they're learning 2 years to renovate that house to where it will rent at a premium for the neighborhood it's in. They then hunt for a new house. And as soon as they have a contract on the house and they know when they'll be out by, they start marketing the house for rental. They move into the new home. They move a tenant in. They have, like he said, an emergency budget that's sitting there for repairs to the home. And they do it to another house. They get in that house. They will generally get it ready to rent in about half the time of the first house because they've done it before. They're more efficient, they know what to do, etc., right? And if you do this, you need to start shopping for the next house, you know, 2 months or more before you know you're going to be ready to rent. So you're looking to know the market well. You're going to then move into that new house and repeat the process. And I know people who have done it with 3 or 4 houses before they're like, you know what, I have enough cash flow and enough real estate equity now. This house is going to be for me, and I'll do additional flips or additional rental properties with other housing now. But that's the way I've seen people do it part-time, quite effectively, by the way. Next up, have you ever heard of a stingray? Not the flat little thing that stabs you in the leg if you step on it, but a stingray device. What is a stingray device, and why do you need to know? Let's find out from Jesse Markowitz.
Hi, this is Jesse Markowitz with YourPersonalBitcoinAssistant.com. Today, I have a question about stingrays. Not the fish, the technology. This topic came up at the fall workshop, and I was very surprised by how many people had never even heard of this. A stingray is a brand name for a type of cell site simulator created by Harris Corporation. There are many other manufacturers, but this is the name that they're commonly known by. They pretend to be a normal cell tower, so nearby phones connect to it. Once a phone connects, the stingray can capture the phone's internal identifier, locate the device, gather metadata, who you're connecting to, for how long, and in some cases, even intercept calls or texts. They're small and portable enough to even be installed in cars, planes, and drones. The technology's been around for a long time, at least the mid-90s, and local agencies like Baltimore Police Department were using them as early as 2007. Today, they're used not just by the military and three-letter agencies for use overseas, but in the United States and Europe and other locations to spy on regular citizens. Recent reports include Virginia and Massachusetts state police purchasing 5G-capable simulators for unmarked vehicles. At the 2024 Democratic National Convention in Chicago, there were reports of strange cell tower behavior consistent with a cell site simulator. Perhaps folks protecting VIPs, perhaps spying on protesters, maybe both. In 2025, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, purchased surveillance vans equipped with cell site simulators to locate phones of interest. In general, in the United States, you would expect Fourth Amendment protection with a warrant required for their usage. Some states require warrants, some do not. Even where required, sometimes actual practice may not match to what they should do. There's not a lot of transparency in who's using these, when, or why. Without that transparency, oversight and protection for regular people is very difficult. Here's the key issue. When the stingray is pretending to be a cell tower, any nearby phone can be connected, not just the target. That means that your phone, regular people's phones, innocent phones, may be swept up, logged, and tracked, even if they're not targeted. Some devices, some of these cell phone simulator devices, actually force a downgrade to older, less secure network protocols. So you may be trying to connect on a 5G, and it may dump you down to a 4, 3, or even 2G connection, so the phone and your connection is more vulnerable. Many of these operations are secret. Sometimes defense lawyers or even the judges aren't told that the technology was used. So, things you can do. Number one, just be aware. Don't have to be paranoid, but knowing the technology exists and how it operates, that's your first line of defense. If you're interested, the Electronic Frontier Foundation has released an open source tool called Rayhunter, which runs on a low-cost mobile hotspot and can help you look for signs of these cell site simulator activities. I actually did a demo of this at the fall workshop in a breakout session. You can also use newer cell phones and make sure their operating systems are kept up to date. These should be less vulnerable. Finally, where you can, use encrypted messaging apps to further encrypt and protect your data. This has been Jesse Markowitz with yourpersonalbitcoinassistant.com. Please send more questions into Jack, and feel free to reach out to me if I can be of any assistance.
That's something really to be acutely aware of, and I'm going to tell you that problems that involve spoofing, spying, gaining information, and leveraging it through AI tools to scam people, to extort people, etc., that's only going to get worse as time goes on, I promise you. So you should know about all of these technologies. I will tell you, like, not related to stingrays directly, but during the workshop, someone attempted to spoof my wife with a health insurance scam, and it was very sophisticated. And what totally blew any chance they had was, one, she's surrounded by people to check with, but two, it was from a health insurance company that we don't actually have or ever had. But this will continue to get worse. Someone, when we talked about it at the workshop, said that they had a call where they really believed they were talking to one of the loan officers they actually knew in real life at a local bank. But there were just some things that were just off. And so I would tell you that we are rapidly getting into a place where we need additional protocols to safeguard things and not to ever give out any personal information that can be used in a negative way to anybody without some sort of double verification that they actually are who they say they are. Because some of this shit is now being done on things like FaceTime, where you see the person on the other end and you actually know what they look like, and it isn't them. And the technology for doing that, it's all pretty weak right now. If you know what to look for, you can spot it almost instantly still. But the improvement in it over the last couple years is exponential, and there's no reason to believe that's going to stop anytime soon. So be ready. All right, next up, let's hear from Matt Sersley on five businesses you can start as side hustle businesses that are relatively easy. Anybody can probably do at least one of them. And you would start a business like this, at least initially, primarily for the tax advantages. I will have a few thoughts on that before my anchor segment today when I come back. But let's hear from Matt first.
Hey, TSP crew. Matthew Sersley with AgoristTaxAdvice.com here to talk about saving money on taxes. Now, let's be honest. Most people pay way more in taxes than they need to, and that's because they don't have a business. As I've talked about before, the tax code wasn't written for employees. It's written for business owners. When you've got a legitimate business, even a very small side gig, you unlock an entirely different set of rules, over 90% of the tax code. Suddenly, things like your phone, your computer, your parts of your home, travel, education, equipment, these can all become tax deductible. So today, let's talk about five easy businesses you can start to open the door to some of those tax savings. Number one, to me, this is the easiest one of all, freelancer consulting side gig. Use what you already know. If you've got any sort of professional skills, writing, marketing, design, editing, coding, tutoring, bookkeeping, whatever, you can freelance or consult on your own terms. And I'll tell you, particularly even if you don't know how to do it, learning a skill like bookkeeping or designing a website can be a great way to start a side gig. All you really need is an LLC, a simple website, and a way to get paid. The beauty of this one is you can really take as little or as much work as you like. Even working just one weekend a month is still a business. Things you can commonly deduct for this are things like your computer, phone, home office space, any software subscriptions. travel to meet clients or conferences, and of course, any educational courses or certifications. Number two is make an ebook or a digital course. If you've got a lot of expertise or just passion for a topic, turn it into an ebook or an online course. There's lots of platforms for selling it. Gumroad, Teachable, even YouTube can now host it and sell it for you. It takes a lot more setup time because you got to actually create the thing, but with smart use of AI, it isn't that hard to do these days. It's so easy because you just need to start with free tools and a phone camera or a web camera. Use something like Zoom to record everything. There's no shipping, no inventory, no office hours, no direct contact with anybody other than by email. So deductible expenses for this, obviously your computer, your webcam, your microphone, any course hosting or editing software, any marketing expenses, and any books or training to buy to improve your skills. This can be particularly great if it's, you know, something you love doing. Well, now you get paid to learn more about what you want to do. That takes us to number three, craft or hobby monetization. Do you already have a hobby where you make something? Sell what you make. Could be woodworking, resin art, candles, knitting or crocheting. Make any of those into a business by simply putting your products on Etsy or going to some local markets. If you're already doing it for fun, why not let the IRS subsidize your supplies? Deductible expenses for this, tools and materials, storage and workspace, any online store fees, website hosting or advertising, and travel for craft fairs or conventions. Number four, takes a little bit of skill. Not everybody's going to be able to do this, but it's actually one of my favorites. It's event or wedding photography. Photography is really the perfect weekend business. You can start with a used camera, learn as you go, build clients from word of mouth. Now again, this does take skill and consistency, but once you book four or five shoots, it tends to be incredibly flexible and scale very easily as you have time. Deductible expenses for this are, of course, the camera, lenses, lighting, editing software, any advertising, continuing education or workshops, and, of course, mileage and travel to events. And if it's a destination wedding in Hawaii, well, now that trip to Hawaii you want to take becomes a business expense. By the way, all four of these, I think if you wanted to do something like go to a workshop, like the TSP or LFTM workshop, those would be deductible business expenses for any of these businesses. Number five is a little different. It's business for if you have a lot of money and not a lot of time. It's real estate investing. Buying even one rental property suddenly puts you in business. And it opens the door to some of the most powerful deductions in the tax code. Not only do you get regular deductions like travel, education, etc., but you get things like depreciation. It's quite possible to make thousands of dollars a month in real estate and pay zero income tax on that income. But you can start small. A single rental or Airbnb still counts and is still a business. Again, very easy to deduct mileage or travel to visit properties, education and seminars related to real estate, things like that. This can be great if there's an area of the country you go commonly. This is why I own real estate in Memphis, Tennessee. I have in-laws there, and so when we go to visit them for holidays, that is a business trip for me because I also go visit my properties, see my property manager, etc. So, these are just five I came up with in a couple of minutes, and yes, I did use ChatGPT to come up with this list and about 50 other things. If you want to start a business, you can start a business. I guarantee there is something you can do. And most of them take either just a little bit of time or just a little bit of money to get started. Now, whether you've already got a business or you're just thinking about starting one, here's the bottom line. If you're paying $30,000 or more a year in federal income taxes, you are definitely leaving money on the table. And that's where I come in. I help business owners and high-earning W-2 employees use the tax code the way it was meant to be used so you can legally keep more of what you earn. If that sounds like you, please grab my free guide to tax deductions at agoristtaxadvice.com/TSP. Thanks, everyone.
I like how that final option dovetailed with Antonio's segment. And I think there's a lot of chemistry here, because of course one of our most prolific expert council members as far as creating content for you is not on this week, not because I don't have content, because I'm keeping one of his items in the bank for the next EC segment, since with him and one other I'm down to two in the bank, plus Chris Rossini's always good for one, so I got three in the bank right now, and that's it. I need about six to do a show, so I held back on him. But he's also a real estate investor. In fact, it's how he derives the majority of his income. So we have a tax attorney who's also a real estate guy. We have a dude that knows home improvement like crazy who's also a real estate guy. And we have a CrossFit nutritional guy that's a real estate guy. There could be a whole bunch of collaboration between those guys. So again, give Antonio some runway with these real estate questions, and there will be times I'll say, hey, why don't you know you and why don't Andy also chime in? Or from a tax perspective, why doesn't Matt chime in on that? Now, one thing I want to say is some of the other businesses were pretty small potatoes business, at least they would start out as such, and people often think like they think two backwards ways at the same time, one or the other, on you know tax deductions and business. Some people think that it actually does make sense to start up a business only so it'll lose money for tax purposes. Losing money's losing money. Got it? You don't start a business with the intent to lose money, and that mindset comes from the must-be-nice, bitter-ass, little bitch attitude that so many people have. Like, that billionaire has that business, it's a tax write-off. You don't know anything about money or business, so shut up, okay? But the other side is, but if I make money in a business, then I have more income, and since I have more income, I actually pay more taxes. So unless I'm actually all in on business, that it doesn't really help me that much. That's the opposite, 180 out from the first position. It's also incorrect. And the reason is that there are many things that you would do anyway that the minute you become legitimate as a business owner, become tax deductible. And your business can, in fact, lose money, and that is a tax advantage, if it loses money on paper, not in the real world. And as Matt said, one thing to really understand this, to really grasp it, you have to get, is this tax code was not written by politicians. The tax code was largely written by lobbyists who worked for businesses, and it was tailor-made to businesses so that businesses had advantages that employees did not. And that is where we change the calculus in earning from an employee earns, pays taxes, and spends what's left. A business earns, spends, and pays taxes on what's left. When you're in the world of being a sell, you know, like me, a solo entrepreneur, that's a pretty big difference. Because a tremendous amount of my expenditures move over to the spend before your tax category, but not all of them do. When you work a job and run a business, you're in kind of a hybrid world where less moves over, but some does, and that matters. So you can have a business that maybe makes you $5,000 in reportable profit, but it disposes of so many expenses that you would have had anyway that even though you feel like you paid higher taxes because you paid tax on the business gain and you paid matching SSI on the, because know that. Unless you hit the cap, which is really high now, if you have, let's say, if you earn enough money that you would have paid, let's say, $1,200 in Social Security on that money if you'd earned it as earned income in your job, you're going to pay $2,400. But the other side is that $1,200 of that $2,400 comes off your income. You get half of your Social Security match, right? You get the match on the Social Security as a deduction. The other thing that will happen is your tax preparation expense will probably go up to have somebody do your additional tax work for you, but that becomes a tax deduction in the next tax year. So year one of a business, your tax prep is not deductible because the tax prep takes place for the payments. It takes place after the fact. Okay, so but that will carry in. So after by year two, year one's fees that you paid an accountant to file your taxes for you, which you should do. If you do it by yourself, that's fine. But if you have enough income that this matters, then I'm telling you, a good CPA will more than pay for themselves. The fees they charge you will then go against the next tax year. So that's a benefit as well. Then remember, you do have to make a profit It's either once every 4 or once every 5 years. It's been so long since I ain't made a profit, I don't even think about it anymore. But that doesn't mean that you can't say you made a profit when you didn't and restart the system. You are required to report all your revenue. There is no requirement to report all your expenses. And then you got to start thinking about all the things you can turn into expenses. Matt did a great segment earlier in the year, something I'd never really even thought about before. And that was that if you have a home office, then if you go to your home office before you get in your vehicle to go do business, then you've started your mileage. Versus if I leave my home and I have like 3 stops, right? I'm going to only be able to deduct the mileage between stop 1 and 2 and stop 2 and 3. And I cannot deduct the mileage to 1 or from 3 home. But if I have a home office, not only do I get the square footage allotted deduction against my housing expenses, now I can deduct all of those legs as long as I do something, anything in my office with Dr. Evil air quotes before I leave and when I get back. And I would always document what you did, write it down right in your mileage log in case you're ever audited. Okay? I think Matt is an incredible asset. I'm glad we have him. We need to all be thinking this way. If you haven't seen his presentation, he did a bang-up presentation at TSP 25. He ended up with the anchor slot, the last place on the last day. Nobody wants it, but everybody that presents regularly has to take a turn there. And he did a bang-up job. I only got to listen to parts of it, mostly outside with the AV. You can hear the audio outside because I had some stuff going on at that point, getting ready for the last night's meal. But it was fantastic. All the presentations are on my YouTube channel. There's a playlist for them. You can look up TSP25 on my channel, and you can find all of them. And his presentation was basically that not being aggressive with your taxes is the real risk. And he made, in the first 10 minutes, an airtight case of how accurate that was. And it's totally worth a listen, especially this time of year as we're winding down and getting ready to ramp up 2026. All right, with that, I want to read to you the email that was sent to me that's got my segment chosen for this week. Here we go. This person writes to me. She says, "My name's Molly. I'm 27 years old, and my boyfriend and I love your podcast. I learned so much since I started listening. I own a house. I have money invested with a financial advisor handling the majority of it. I have concerns, though. I feel like a lot of what I was told to do with finances growing up is not the best way to go about it after listening to some of your episodes. I want to diversify my investments, but now I feel stuck with most of my money tied in my investments with the advisor. I understand that you're not a financial advisor yourself, but you seem to have your shit together. I want to just cover my ass to do the smartest thing when it comes to money I've worked hard to earn. Do you have any advice for me on this? It's been on my mind a lot. Thank you." Okay, so what I want to start out with is there's a real disposition, specifically when a person begins to acquire enough money where it actually starts to matter, and they're in kind of that age bracket, 25 to 35, which Molly's sitting right in. It's a great age to be, by the way, Molly. Enjoy it while you can, because it will go away, and you will one day be an old fart like me. But that said, where you start saying, "I expect more of a return," and sometimes that's a reasonable expectation, and sometimes it's not, and it's really not when you're sitting at like all-time highs of markets, which we're close to in many places now. So be cautious. The next thing I would say is you want to diversify your investments. I think that you and your boyfriend should sit down with pen and paper and figure out what that means. What does that mean? Does that mean you want to, like we just had a segment on real estate, does that mean you want to invest in real estate? Maybe that's worth doing. Does that mean that you want to buy alternative assets? For instance, do you want to buy Bitcoin? And we're entering a weird part of the cycle. Are we going to have a major correction, a partial correction? We don't know right now what we're going to have. At this time in history suggests a top has been reached and a major retraction's in order. So if you want to go in that space, I'm not going to say don't do it, because I'm going to buy Bitcoin every day for the rest of my life. But I'm going to say use caution and use dollar cost averaging going back into it. But if you're in conventional investments with an advisor, something like a Roth IRA, or you have investments outside of retirement accounts so that they remain liquid or what have you, well, then you have tools like the ETFs to get Bitcoin exposure, or tools like fixed income instruments from MicroStrategy, including one that pays a 10% guaranteed coupon rate, you know, and some other options there. Is that what you, I don't know what you mean by diversify. Diversify. That might mean, hey, we want to move and we want to buy a property that we see, even though we're going to live on it, it's an investment property because it's an income. There's so many things that could, I think you need to know what you mean by that. I'm not happy with sitting in five mutual funds. I would probably, or five ETFs or whatever, mid-cap, you know, growth and income, bond, I probably would feel the same way if I were you. I'd want to, but what does that mean? Because then you can do the important thing that you should do before you fire this guy, and that is you should say, these are our concerns. We want greater diversity in our investments. Can you help us? You're going to get one of two answers. I can absolutely help you with that, or some version of bullshit of why you shouldn't do it. Okay. Now, it might be, yes, we can, but these are some mitigate. No, that's not bullshit. When it's, hey, look, you know, our firm is very conservative and we want to make sure that we stay on track. And you're like that kind of bullshit. Like if it sounds like a script, it is. And then it's time to get rid of the guy. So then you need to start, if you're going to continue to use an advisor, and based on your email and what it seems that you're not sure about, that may be a really good idea. You need to start in interviewing new advisors. You're not stuck with this guy. You don't sign contracts with investment advisors that go 10 years. You can fire these people whenever you want. And whenever they're not getting the job done, they should be fired. And you can move the management of those assets to a new broker, a broker advisor or investment manager. And you don't have to, like, you don't have to liquidate your funds or anything like that to do this. You just put a different person in charge of the same investment so you don't have, let's say, the tax consequences of liquidating an investment. There are things that can trap some of your money, though. Like, I don't know how much money you have, because if you have $10,000, this is pretty academic, and it's more about what you do with the new money than the old, because it's not enough money that it's that big of a deal. Even though it can feel like it to you. If it's just $100,000, we're in a different area with the calculus here as to what we do with the existing money. Now, if some of this existing money is held up in things like our IRAs, you are stuck in that vehicle to a degree. Remember this always. If you have a Roth IRA, there's a certain amount of money you contributed to it, and there's a certain amount of money you earned inside of it, hopefully. And you can get the money that you contributed back out into some other form of investment vehicle, like just being an open investment in the market or move into some other form with zero penalty. So if you have a Roth IRA, for instance, with $50,000, let's say $100,000 in it, and the money that you've placed into it over the years has done fairly well, but you've put about $30,000 in, so $30,000 is contribution and $70,000 is gains, you can withdraw up to $30,000 and pay no penalties. This is not true of certain types of annuities where they literally have last in, first out, right? They always write the code to benefit themselves. That's something that you need to know. So you need to be clear on all of these things as you hunt for a new investment advisor, but just know that you can get a new advisor and you can take a different direction with your investments. And then the other thing is, and I kind of alluded to this, but I want to be clear on it as we go forward, you do not necessarily have to do much different with the money you've already invested. You can always stop contributing to that group of investments, even if you replace the manager of those investments with someone who maybe you feel will do a better job for you. You can always start directing your new investment contributions into new things. So if you, for instance, wanted Bitcoin in self-custody and it was going to cost you serious penalties to get money out of what you already have, because for some reason iBit or something like that wasn't available inside, or you just wanted self-custody, I would say start doing that with, stop giving this guy your money or stop giving any advisor your money and take control of some of your contributions yourself and do that directly. If you know, for instance, that you want to own Bitcoin, there's no reason to pay somebody a management fee over Bitcoin. So you could then buy it yourself. The same thing with precious. If you want to physically hold precious metal, then use your new contributions and buy in over time just as you made your prior contributions. I hope that all makes sense. Again, I would sit down with several new potential advisors, and I would look for someone who is vested into and informed on the type of things that you want to do going forward. But I would first be clear on what those things are, why you want to do them. Is it just because you heard me talk about them, or do you understand the investment? Sit down with your boyfriend, figure out what you want in your life out of your investments, what diversity means to you, and then find someone help you craft that vision. Rather than saying, I feel trapped with it. You're not trapped. Again, you can be somewhat economically trapped inside investment vehicles like tax deferred or tax exempt accounts. You are never trapped with a broker. He is not someone you are married to. You did not join the military. Anyway, with that, I hope you guys enjoyed today's show. If you did, again, consider doing your online shopping at tspaz.com. That is T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. Our items of the day this week were the Merton & Stork Carbon Steel Skillets, the Meter Block Thermometer, the Hamilton Beach 3-in-1 Egg Cooker, and the 22-quart Roaster Oven. All of those are fantastic. All of those are beneficial in the holiday that we're coming up. If you want to know more about them, just go by today's episode, episode 3763, and there's links in the show notes. Also, MSB's on sale, $35 a year discount. Code word is turkey. You can sign up for MSB with that, and you can save a bunch of money on something that already saves you money. And my book, Laws of Life, Digital System Design Your Life, is on sale and available at Amazon in Kindle, audiobook, and soft cover hard copy. With that, I'll say goodbye and thank you for tuning in this week. I enjoyed this week. Next week will be a somewhat abbreviated week. We will have new shows on Monday and Tuesday. We will run the Thanksgiving special on Wednesday. And then, like most of you, I will be off Thursday and Friday through to Cyber Monday, and then we'll be back that next week and we'll do it all over again. Again, thank you for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who supports this show, who shares it, who participates in it. Without you, I and my family could never live the life that we do, so thank you for it. Every year around Thanksgiving, we talk about what we're thankful for. There is nothing I am more thankful for in my life other than my wife, my son, and my grandchildren than this community. And every time I do a workshop and I get to see this community interact with each other, my gratitude grows. So thank you to everyone who's ever been to a workshop or an event where I'm at, shook my hand, talked to me, and thank you to everyone who's ever listened to even 5 minutes of this show. I appreciate you. I could not have a life I do without you. Take care, guys. I'll catch you on Monday with a new episode. Just run you round. They said you should have a house. The American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.